This is the Bible Show. Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Bible Show. My name is Sam. Joining me is Will, and we are continuing our series in the life of Abraham, jumping into Genesis 22.
A big one.
A big one. This is probably, would you say this is the climax of Abraham's journey of faith?
For sure, and also the most wild.
Yeah, it's wild on a number of levels. First off, because this is something that skeptics will throw in the face of Christians, like, what kind of God do you serve? Because God's going to have an unbelievable request for Abraham, which is
sacrifice his son Isaac.
You're going to sacrifice your son. And so then we're left with all these questions like, whoa, what kind of, like, this isn't the kind of character that I expected coming from our God. And it's certainly not something that I would expect Abraham to follow through on. And yet both of those seem to be true. You've got all this reference to child sacrifice, all these things that with 21st century righteous ears, we're like, this makes no sense to me. I absolutely hate it. And yet, if you hang with us through this episode, what you find is something very, very beautiful. And of all the chapters in the story of Abraham's life, this is the most obviously pointing to the fulfillment that's coming in Jesus.
Yeah, for sure, the most explicit.
Absolutely. By the time we get done, like, so many of the details that God is laying out, and he's kind of sending Abraham on a mission that we're going to spoil it from the beginning. He doesn't kill his son.
Well, yeah, just, you know, because the next chapter, his son's still alive. So
yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, but we have this story playing out, and it's like, okay, God must have a reason for this. He doesn't just send Abraham with all these details and all these specifics of what he's to accomplish and then say, ah, just kidding, don't do it at the end of it, without there being a reason for why he laid out the story as he has. And what we'll find as we go through the story is 2,000 years before Jesus comes into the world, before this God takes on flesh, the very God that is commanding Abraham to do these things will take on flesh and live out the story that he is asking Abraham to do to his son. And when you think about it from that perspective, this story takes on an all totally different gravity to it. And it's going to come with a very, very stern rejection of child sacrifice, which would have been common throughout the cultures of that day. So, like, let's set some mission statements. This story is going to set God's people apart as the opponents of child sacrifice in a time period when this is pretty common, and in an area where it's very common. It's going to show that Abraham can trust God's commands even though they make no sense at all.
Yeah, it's a test. We'll see that early on.
God will tell him this was a test. Three, the story presents a powerful teaching and a foreshadowing of Jesus, which is my favorite of all of them. Like, it's
clear.
So obvious that that's what is going on here. And then last, I think for Abraham's good, he is building into Abraham this absolute conviction that his God is a God of life, that overcomes death, that overcomes barrenness, and he is cementing that into Abraham's mind and heart for Abraham's own good, because as we'll see, all of the stuff that Abraham has done over his lifetime, all of the stumbles that he has, it's always because he's afraid of what? He's afraid of dying, right? So, I mean, when you think of Genesis 12, when he gets to the land, right? The land is in famine, and what does he do? Does he trust God in the land that he's going to provide for him?
No, I'm going to die here. I got
to
go.
He bails to Egypt because he's afraid of death. He doesn't trust God. You jump forward a number of chapters, and you see where he doesn't trust God to overcome barrenness. So when his wife says, hey, why don't you sleep with my maidservant? What does he do?
Sure.
Well, I don't think God's going to overcome this, so sure, I'm in. Or you see when he goes down to Gerar and he says, hey, Sarah, pretend that you're my wife. He did the same thing with Pharaoh. Pretend that you're my wife, because if they think pretend that you're my sister, say that all over again. Pretend that you're my sister. Otherwise, they'll kill me if they think you're my wife. Mm-hmm. What is he afraid of?
Death.
Death. So all of these stories where Abraham stumbles, it's because I don't think that God can bring life out of this. I don't think that God can spare me from death. But after Genesis 21, where God has brought forth a child, Isaac to a wife who is postmenopausal, who has been barren her whole life, and you see the power of God to bring life over death. Now Abraham is a changed man.
Yeah, he's commendable in this almost.
He is like, I absolutely know beyond a shadow of a doubt that if my God is calling me to do something, I can trust in his promises and life will triumph over death. And that's what you see as this chapter plays out. All right, so let's dive right in. Genesis 22, starting with the very first verse, it says, after these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. Abraham said, here I am. He's attentive. It's like, what do you need from me? I'm your servant. Like, I'm on board. What do you need? Verse 2, he said, God said, take your son, your only son, Isaac. Now, that's an interesting thing because he's got a son, Ishmael. But what is God saying? Of the covenant line, this is your only son, Isaac, whom you love. And go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. Now, we could park here for quite a long time because God, there's so much loaded into this very first verse. For example, one of the things that it's saying is, I want you to take your son and go to the land that I'm going to show you, right? To the land of Moriah. Mm-hmm. So this is a huge ask. He's saying, hey, I want you to take your son, which is the hope of salvation. It's your entire future. And I want you to put him on an altar for me. I want you to be able to look at all of your tomorrows, all of your eternity. And I want you to put it on an altar and I want you to trust me with it, which is the biggest ask of faith that God has ever had Abraham perform. But if you go back to the very beginning in Genesis 12, what did God do? He's like, this one is give up your son. What was the first call?
Give up everything.
Give up your father.
Yeah.
Give up everything that you have been, everything that you had accumulated, all of your comforts of your hometown and your wealth and the place that's fertile and your dad and his household and his gods and everything else. I want you to walk away from everything that you've had in the past. Mm-hmm. And Abraham's like, ooh, okay. And he does it. And now he's walked this long 25-year road with the Lord, and God has come through on his promise. And now what is God saying? Okay, now that you trust me in resurrection, I want you to give me all your tomorrows. I want you to give me everything that you're hoping on in the future. Like Isaac, the promise, everything. Can you trust me with it? Now that you have it, can you trust me with it? You've given me your yesterdays. You've let that go. Can you give me all your tomorrows? And this is a huge ask. And that's, you know, it's interesting when I came to faith, you know, it was like coming out of a lot of brokenness, addiction, sadness, like, is this really all there is kind of a feeling. And so when God said, are you willing to leave all that for me?
Yeah.
I mean, I got some sinful nature that's kind of hard to let go of, but yeah, I'm happy to walk away from that and to hope for a better future and everything else. But then it's like once you start having a family, you know, then I had a wife and then I started having sons and a daughter and I started building a ministry and then all that. And it's like, if God came to me and says, I want you to lay all of that down for me, everything that you now have because you're walking with me, I want you to lay it all down and entrust me with it. Would you put it on the altar? Would you put your marriage on the altar? Would you put your fatherhood on the altar? Your ministry, good things, right? Would you put them on the altar and trust him with them? And you know, it's like we want to say, what does that mean? Like, am I sacrificing? And that's not what I'm asking. It's like, would you literally give God your marriage and say, I trust you with it more than me?
Yeah.
Would you say, you know what, God, I trust you with my kids, even when it feels like their futures are uncertain and I feel like I've got to control it. Am I willing to say, I trust you with it and put even my kids on the altar? Would I put my ministry on the altar and say, if you want to kill it, like this is yours, I trust you with whatever you do. And what is that? That's a terrifying thing to trust your tomorrows to the Lord, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, what do you experience when you do it?
I mean, the freedom of it all.
Freedom and peace. And you learn this God
is trusted.
He can be trusted. And so this is a new dynamic. It's not leave your father. It's give me your son.
Yeah, and the thing that you waited all this time for.
That's right.
Because, I mean, one of the big things about God is like, well, God, why take him through all this?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a crazy ask because you're the one who said, hey, I'm going to give you a son. He's the promise of the world. And now all of a sudden, you change your mind. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot more questions about God come up to be like, okay, what is your character then?
Yeah. And this is why, like, when you get to Hebrews 11, it'll tell you that Abraham believed that God was going to raise him from the dead, which means Abraham so firmly trusts in the promise of God. God said that through Isaac, all the nations of the world are going to be blessed, that through Isaac, the salvation of the world is going to come. God is not going to let death have the last word over Isaac. So I'm willing to obey this crazy mission that I can't make sense of, knowing that God is not going to allow Isaac to die. He will perform a resurrection before he breaks his promise. So here, I can trust you with Isaac. And we have so many of those same promises. Of course, we shouldn't ever do this because God is vehemently opposed to child sacrifice, and he's told us that. So if God ever comes to you and says, give up your son,
that's Satan.
You're crazy. Yeah. You need to check yourself into a hospital. But in this particular case, what he's asking is, can you give me your greatest treasure and all of your hopes and trust me with them? And that's the reality is, as a dad, it begins to set into me that when I'm raising up my kids, the more I give them to the Lord, the more that I raise them in the Lord, the more I'm certain not to lose them ever, right? Yeah. Like if I give them over to the world and they chase after the world and they reject the Lord,
there's no eternity in it.
The grave swallows everything they are and everything they do. But if they grab hold of the Lord because I've given them to him and trust him with them, now I get my family back. I get my wife back. I get what I've lived for back. And so God is training up Abraham and by extension us to have a resurrection perspective to everything, that this life is not all there is, that he's a God that overcomes it. But now let's walk through this request. And what do you hear in this? Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love. What do you notice there?
It's very detailed. It's almost like God pressing a finger into it all. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, your son, not just any son, your only son, not just the only son you have, but the one whom you really, really love.
Mm-hmm.
That one.
It's like every new thing he's driving in why this is painful.
Yeah.
Like, this is your son, like you said, your only son, whom you love. But what are you hearing there? Your only beloved son.
Yeah, very New Testament-y.
Right? This is Jesus, right? This is the parallel to what God the Father will do with his son,
mm-hmm.
his only son, his son whom he loves. And then he says, you're to take him and go to the land of Moriah. Now, what should jump off the page to us if we know our biblical geography, which who does, is that the land of Moriah is not some random place in the Bible. Like we're told in 2 Chronicles 3:1, where is this?
It's Jerusalem.
It's Jerusalem. So in verse 1, 2 Chronicles 3:1, it says, then Solomon began to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah. So the temple is built in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah. And here you have God saying to Abraham, I want you to take your son, your only son, your son whom you love, and go to Jerusalem. And to do what with him there? Well, offer him as a burnt offering on one of the mountains. Well, what's a burnt offering in the Bible?
Like, for forgiveness for sin.
This is, and even in other cultures, so Abraham would have been familiar with this from other cultures. When you offer up a burnt offering, it was meant to seek atonement, to appease the gods for something that you've done wrong. And going all the way back to Abel in Genesis 4, right? He makes a sacrifice to God. It's pleasing to the Lord. There's a humility in this. And so he's to offer his son, his only son, whom he loves in Jerusalem on a mountain as a burnt offering, which means if you're Abraham, why do you think God is asking you to do this? Why a burnt offering?
Yeah, like, what did I do wrong?
That's it.
What have I done that I need to sacrifice so I can be atoned for?
This only beloved son is going to be sacrificed in Jerusalem because of your sin.
Yes.
Gee, does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
This is 2,000 years before Jesus. And I mean, God is just, he is singing the gospel here. And he makes this, I mean, it's an outrageous request. So like if somebody came up to you and they said to you, how could you worship a God who could say to somebody that he loves? I mean, Abraham is called a friend of God. How could you worship a God who would ask somebody to do something like this? What's the answer?
Yeah, that's why I've heard someone say this to me. Is like, how is your God a cosmic child abuser?
Yeah, I've heard that too, yeah.
Oh, okay.
A cosmic child abuser. That's a favorite among the skeptics. They love to go to that one. But What do you say to them?
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the story, I mean, to blow the story again, what is God going to say? No, absolutely not. I will not allow this to happen. In fact, he goes through the Old Testament law. And if there's anything that God emphatically says he will not tolerate is child sacrifice again and again and again in the harshest of terms. And yet he asks Abraham to do this here and then paints the story before he says, no, Abraham, I won't allow it. And then paints the story of his son. You know what's going on here? Is he wants, I think God is intentionally telling this story to stir up in us this, you know, we want to point the finger up at God and go, how in the world could you? What kind of a monster would require a father to give his own son as a burnt offering on a mountain in Jerusalem? And our fingers are going up and God says, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, if I can speak on God's behalf for a moment,
yeah.
God stepped in and said, absolutely not. He would not require that of you. Because he loves you too much. You know what God did instead? In the Trinity, God made the decision that the Father would give his only beloved son so that you don't have to die.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't a monster. This is the greatest expression of love. And, you know, it's not like the cosmic child abuser. That's such a poor understanding of the Bible, because it's not like Jesus becomes a man and is like, oh, what am I doing here? Like, I didn't ask for this. Yeah. You know, you're punishing me. I didn't. This is a decision that the Trinity has made in the courts of heaven from eternity past. I mean, read Ephesians. What does it say? That we're chosen in him from the foundations of the world, that the Lamb's Book of Life was written before the first days of existence. How is that possible unless Jesus, who is God, who existed way prior to creation, for eternity past, is up there going, this is my story too, and I choose it. This isn't God the Father saying, ha ha, deal with this, son. This is God the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit covenanting together to create a universe and a chosen race, his special treasured possession, and to redeem them and to die for them and to tell a story that's unbelievably beautiful and redemptive from the beginning of time, and Jesus is on board with it. But what he won't allow, that our God is so good, is what he won't allow is he's like, you can't pay this.
Yeah, can't figure it out on your own.
I got it. Not a cosmic child abuser.
Not at all.
Not a monster. Unbelievably loving. And so, on a mountain, only son, beloved son, whom you love, in Jerusalem, sacrifice for sin. And we get to verse 3. And it says, so Abraham rose early in the morning. What do you hear in that?
I mean, he's obedient. And it's a quick obedience.
It's quick obedience.
And it's what I've always thought. Is he just avoiding the conversation with Sarah? Which I think is a bad way. You know, like, hey, she's going to have something to say about this.
Yeah.
But then as we go through this, we'll see, like you've been saying, like, he really does believe Isaac is coming home tonight.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's almost not even like, hey, I don't even need to have that conversation with Sarah, because it's just unnecessary, because our son's going to be back in the house tonight.
I don't want to traumatize her. I don't want to traumatize her. So early in the morning, probably after a sleepless night, because this isn't, hey, you got to understand, Abraham is not going, la-da-da-da-da, going to sacrifice my son. Like, he knows what that looks like. I mean, if you're imagining what's going to be necessary, like, is Isaac going to be willing? Is he going to panic? Am I going to have to restrain him? Like, what do I have to do with the knife?
In the end, I'm still going to have to stab my son if I have to go through with this.
I'm the one who has to light the funeral pyre and watch it if God allows me to go forward with this. Like, if you told me that I had to do this with one of my sons, even if I believed that God would raise him from the dead, like, that's going to be, like,
stressful, at least.
That's going to be on my mind all night, right? And I couldn't make sense of this, but I can tell you Abraham has seen gods that require far worse in that ancient world. And so it says, so Abraham rose early in the morning. He saddled his donkey. There's another little detail. How are they going to Jerusalem? On a
donkey.
Can you think of anyone else who rode into Jerusalem to give himself as an offering for sin on a donkey?
Jesus. And it is one of those stories where, like, it has to be pointed to something else, because you're like, God's asked him to kill his son at the end of this, and there's all of these details. You're like, we didn't need to know that.
Yeah.
Like, fast forward here. Like, Genesis, you don't talk about things a lot. Like, I don't need to know he's on a donkey.
Yeah, why even include this?
It is. Like, I could be any piece of land. Let's get back to the killing of a son.
Yeah.
But here's all the details.
It's a good point. This is all prophetic. And he took two of his young men, so The one who's being sacrificed is coming along with two others and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place that God had told him. And it says, verse 4, on the third day, there's something there. On the third day, when this act, so 3 days, God has imposed a death sentence on Isaac. For 3 days, Abraham has been like, my son is going to die. But on the third day, what's going to happen?
It's going to be changed. He's going to be alive.
God is going to intervene and the decree of death is overthrown.
That is interesting.
On the third day.
That from Abraham's perspective, for 3 days, his son is dead.
Yeah, 100%. In his mind, this is happening. But on the third day, there's going to be a resurrection that comes. Gee, I wonder what God is getting at here. Like, I mean, this is so, like, if I'm a Jewish person and I read the Gospels, there's so many details here that are in the foundational text of the Torah.
Yeah.
And they're all pointing so crystal clear to Jesus. And this is going to be true of every story. As we continue this podcast and go through so many books of the Bible, this is true of every major character of the Old Testament. It's all screaming to what Jesus is ultimately going to fulfill. So on the third day, the day of resurrection, when the decree of death is overthrown, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey, and now listen. I and the boy will go over there, worship, and come again to you. What does that show that Abraham believes?
Somehow or some way, whatever it is, we're both coming back.
That's right. He doesn't say, hey, stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there, and then we're going to worship, and then I will come again to you. The verb stays plural in the Hebrew, which means we are coming back to you. I'm going to go over there. We're going to worship. You can expect both of us are coming back to you. What? Like, didn't you hear God's instruction? You're going to offer him up as a burnt offering, which means you're not just cutting him to where he bleeds to death. You're going to set him on fire. He's going to be reduced to a pile of ash. What do you mean we're both coming back? And I would say if you only gave me Genesis 22, I would be like, oh, maybe he anticipates that God's not going to go through with this. Maybe he's like, maybe because the flip side of this is, okay, God comes to Abraham and says, hey, I want you to go sacrifice your son. And at that moment, if you're thinking Abraham on the cynical side, like, you can imagine Abraham being like, oh, man, I totally thought you were different than all the other gods.
Yep.
I thought you were a God who loved life. I thought you were the God that could overcome barrenness. You've done all these miracles. And now I'm coming to find out you're like all the other gods that require child sacrifice. And that's disappointing, but okay. Like, that's not what's going on here.
Now, and I always used to think even this part where he's like, just like it's a lie to these guys because he doesn't want them to do anything about it.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
But then I thought, no, there is servants. Sadly, in this world, like, those guys are stuck.
Mm-hmm.
If Abraham just chopped off his head right there, they'd be like, sorry, Isaac.
And we live in a 21st century where this is unimaginable. This is commonplace to them back then. Like, if he said child sacrifice, they're like, oh, okay. Like those guys over there, okay, we're in.
Yeah.
You know, like, and by the way, he's a much, much older than the typical child sacrifice. You know, like at this point, you read different commentaries and you got guys like the ancient rabbis that say that Jesus is probably around 30 years old.
Isaac.
That's what.
You yeah, said Jesus,
well, Jesus is 33.
Yeah, we're getting a little too comparative.
they mesh together, right? But Isaac is 30. Josephus, who's a historian of the first century that kind of captures the prevailing beliefs of that day, says that Isaac's 25. Is that how you envision the story?
Not at first, but once, obviously. Yeah, because they say boy, but the name of my Bible's like young man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he's like, we're going to go over there and we're going to come back to you. Let's jump then to Hebrews and listen to what it says about what Abraham is believing. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 17, it says, by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was in the act of offering up his son. Why does it say that? He who had received the promises. It's like God said that this guy, my son, is going to do amazing things. He can't stay dead.
Yeah,
I've received the promises.
Them. Yeah.
So I know that he's going to live because God has never broken his word to me through all the ups and downs that I've had over the past 10 chapters. And so it says, because God said, through Isaac your offspring shall be named, he considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead. So what is Abraham thinking? According to Scripture.
Resurrection.
Resurrection's coming. And then it says, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back from the dead. And so verse 6, Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering, and here's another detail, and laid it on Isaac, his son. What are you to envision there?
Jesus in the cross.
Yeah. How does Jesus get up the mount? Carries.
Back, yeah.
Carries the cross, right? So Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on his son. So his son is carrying the means of his execution. And he took in his hand the fire and the knife. And so they both went on together. And this is like you think of this as this poignant moment where, you know, they're walking in harmony and lockstep. And they keep saying this. They went on together. You'll notice like that's repeated again and again throughout this particular passage. And Isaac is demonstrating faith here. He's like ready to go. Like, I want to worship. Like, we learn a couple of chapters from now, Isaac's faith is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't have as many stumbles as Abraham, his dad, or Jacob, his son. Like, this guy's pretty amazing, we find out. He knows that he's a walking miracle. Can you imagine growing up and knowing that you're the hope of the world and that God overcame barrenness to bring life to you and that everybody who looks at you is like laughing with triumph over your existence and it's like God's favor on you, like you are special. You're set apart. So he's on his way and he's like, we're going to worship. This is awesome. Can't wait. Verse 7, and Isaac said to his father, my father, and he said, here I am, my son. And he said, behold, I see the fire in the wood, but where's the lamb for a burnt offering?
Good question.
Very good question.
And it seems like this place is desolate.
Yeah.
Like Mount Moriah at this stage in history doesn't seem like they're just walking through a city. It seems like we're going alone on a mountain.
Mm-hmm. And Abraham says, God will provide for himself the lamb. And notice that everything here, when you see that, and it'll be repeated again, it's future tense. It's looking forward to a lamb that's going to be provided for a burnt offering, my son. And it's like, I think Abraham believes that. You know, I don't think it's just deceptive. I think he's like, there's going to come a day, because he'll repeat it after God spares Isaac. The Lord is going to provide. He sees this as prophetic in some sense. And so here it is. They went on together. Every bit of this is them in lockstep. And I think Genesis wants you to get this idea that Isaac is very submissive to his father and to the Lord. They went on together. They do everything together. Verse 9, when they came to the place of which God had told him, Abram built an altar there, and he laid the wood in order and bound Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And that's crazy town. This, now we're like, how do you envision this?
Yeah.
Because if the ancient scribes and rabbis are saying he's 30 when this happens, Josephus is saying 25. We know that he's at least old enough to carry the big pile of wood of a funeral pyre up the mountain. His dad's over 100 at this point.
Yeah, how old? Like, whatever the minimum age of being up an over 100-year-old is, like, what, 16?
So Isaac is born when he's 100. Yeah. So if he's 30, Abraham is 130. If he's 25, Abraham's 125. If he's 16, Abraham's 116. We know that his body's beginning to fail. The New Testament tells us that he's as good as dead. Like, everything about this is like, okay, if I'm a 20-year-old and a 116-year-old is trying to restrain me,
I could beat him every day.
Right?
10 like, out of 10 times. I win that fight.
So when you think this through, or you could outrun him for sure.
Anything else.
Like, you could do anything. So if Abraham is willing to get Isaac and to get him in the position of a sacrifice that's going to be offered, what does that suggest?
It's voluntary.
That he was willing to give his own life.
Which is amazing. I mean, the faith of Isaac, but also does show that Abraham has had this change of heart that is being passed on to the next generation. Like, as a father, it seems like Abraham's doing a good job of your son either trust you, which would be huge. If it's just like, even if God is not in his mind, like, hey, dad, I trust you enough to, like, you have my best interest in mind. Or even greater, I think he has the same trust in God that his dad has. Mm-hmm. So it's really beautiful. That's like, oh, this is a generational passing of a resurrection truth, which is amazing to see.
Yeah. I think he believes that he's going to be raised from the dead. And so he's willing. I mean, I'm sure he's probably terrified of what it's going to be like and what's going to happen.
You're not like jazzed.
But he goes through with it. And then you start thinking, okay, let's go back to the beginning and let's put this together. God comes and says, hey, the father is going to give up his only son whom he loves, as a burnt offering, as an atonement for sin, on a mountain in Jerusalem, goes there riding a donkey, surrounded by two other guys, gets there, carries the wood up the mountain, on the third day, where he's going to be delivered from the curse of death, and then he willingly lays down his life. I mean, what if Isaac hears this and is like, wait a minute, if I die as a burnt offering, your sins are forgiven? Is that the way this works?
True.
I'll do that for you, Dad. Yeah. What if that's going on? And I can't say that definitively, but if Abraham says, hey, you're going to be a burnt offering, what does Isaac have to be thinking?
Somebody did something wrong.
And I'll pay the price. I love you that much, Dad. Whew. Whoa. But now that's where the story diverges, because it's not Jesus who dies for the sake of the Father. It's Jesus who dies for the sake of his adopted brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
That's amazing to me. And so we get to this point of Isaac being willing to trust God with his own ashes. And it says, then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. Like, this is about to happen.
Yeah, this is as real as it gets.
But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, so who's the angel of the Lord?
Pre-incarnate Jesus.
Yeah. He knows this story. He sees this story.
He stops the story.
He knows the significance of this story. Like, cosmic child abuser, here you have God calling from heaven saying, no. You're not going to do that. He calls from heaven and says, Abraham, Abraham. And Abraham says, here I am. And he says, do not lay a hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing that you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Like this being spoken from the mouth of God's only beloved son to Abraham, from the same heart that says, I got this. One day I'm going to do all that stuff.
Yeah, you don't have to.
You don't have to.
Get Isaac off the wood. And good thing Abraham wasn't startled or something. I feel like there could have been an easier voice from the sky. I feel like he could have.
Yeah, God's sovereign. He could have stopped it or something. But everything about this, like when he interjects, like, and he calls Abraham, Abraham, you've heard this taught before. Like, what does that mean? In ancient Near East cultures, when you repeat a name,
it's like honorary, right?
Yeah, it's affection.
Yeah.
Like, even today, you go to Eastern cultures, when you repeat a name, William, William, like, it's meant to be affection. There's an endearingness to this. So God is not mad. He's not angry, but he interjects, and it's the angel of the Lord. It's the same angel of the Lord that chased after Hagar. It's the same angel of the Lord that the last chapter showed them a well so that Ishmael didn't have to die. It's this angel of the Lord that keeps showing up all over the place and offering mercy to people that are in exile, offering mercy to people that are on their way to death. And now it's the angel of the Lord that says, no, you are not allowed to take your kids, to sacrifice your son. And so Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and you want to talk about just like, here's a cherry on top of all the other symbolism. Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram. What's a ram?
A male adult sheep.
Very good.
Which Sam is alluding to the fact that I didn't know a ram existed. I thought it was a whole different animal than a lamb. Because every time I read the story before, I was like, would have been really cool if that was a lamb. God, you had all these things and it's going, behold the Lamb of God, that would have worked really well, but he does anyways.
Yeah, male adult, so reach the age of maturity, and it's a ram, so imagine the ram with the horns, and it's caught in a thicket with its horns. So wait, hold on a minute.
Okay, we're not done yet.
The replacement that God says, hey, Isaac, you're not going to be sacrificed. I've got something over there that will do for now, and it's a male sheep with its head crowned by thorns in a thicket. And so Abraham went over there and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So what's going on there?
I mean, straight back to Jesus.
Well, Jesus goes, the only son whom God loves. You know, you go through all the details, except he's going to be the one crowned with thorns. There's no replacement for him.
Yeah.
Behold
the Lamb of God.
There you go. Yeah. There's the Lamb of God crowned with thorns. There's no substitute for him. And so Abram called the name of that place, the Lord, what?
Will provide.
Will. Still coming. Yeah. That ram didn't do it. We're not done. The story's not done yet. There is still a lamb that will be provided on this mountain, on the mount of the Lord. It shall be, verse 14, provided.
Well,
when does that get affirmed? When does that come true? Like, we're not talking about the temple where hundreds of thousands of these animals are going to be slaughtered over the next couple thousand years. It's the lamb will be provided. One. And that's the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. So let's summarize all the ways that this points to Jesus. You ready? The Son will be sacrificed. The only Son whom you love, travel to Moriah, Jerusalem, riding on a donkey, climb a mountain, carrying the wood of the execution, surrounded by the two other guys beforehand. God vows to provide a lamb. The substitute is crowned with thorns. The Son returns alive. The curse of death is overthrown on the third day. Like and it's the angel of the Lord that intervenes and says, no, I got this. Don't allow this. This whole thing is pointing to Jesus. So that's one reason. The next one that we talked about at the beginning that we were going to get into is this is not God coming and saying, I'm for child sacrifice. This is God coming and to the father of the faith saying, I absolutely will not allow you to do this.
Yeah.
I'm going to be different than all the other gods around here. So let me just give you some scriptures of the Old Testament where you hear the heart of God about this issue. Psalm 106, verse 37. Listen to what he's saying about all the tribes that surround the Israelites at that time. It says, they sacrificed their sons and their daughters to the demons. This is a demonic practice. They poured out innocent blood, the blood of their sons and daughters whom they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan, and the land was polluted with their blood. Deuteronomy 12, every abominable thing that the Lord hates, they have done for their gods, for they even burn their sons and their daughters in the fires to their gods. God is giving Abraham an object lesson to say, I'm not that God. We are not like they are. Mm-hmm. And then when the law comes, it's like, it's gross to me. I hate everything about it. Deuteronomy 18:10, there shall not be found among you anyone who burns his son or daughter as an offering, for whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord. And because of these abominations, the Lord your God is driving them out before you. So God comes to Moses in Deuteronomy, and he's like, hey, you just left Egypt, and I'm going to deliver you into the promised land, and I'm going to drive out all these other tribes that currently inhabit the land of Canaan. And why does he say that he's willing to drive them out? Why is he going to allow them to be conquered? Because of these abominations, the Lord your God is driving them out before you. So God looks at child sacrifice and says, their land is now your land. I'm going to defeat them. Mm-hmm. Why did he show up and overthrow the Egyptians? When was it that the cries of the people reached the Lord to where he was like, I'm done with Egypt?
I told them to murder the babies.
When they start murdering the children and God comes and hears the cries and overthrows them. And by the way, he'll drown their entire army in the waters, which is what they had done to the Hebrew children. You get this impression that God has a very, very special place in his heart for the children. What does Jesus say? The greatest in the kingdom of heaven are like little children. What does he say? You know, like if anyone causes one of these little ones to stumble, not to mention killing them, it's better for them to be drowned in the depths of the sea with a millstone around their neck. Like, God is so opposed to the abuse of children, such a special place in his heart, that when anyone comes along and says, oh yeah, this is cosmic child abuser, look at what their God does, it's like, you are so clueless about the heart of God to believe that, when the exact opposite is true.
Yeah, and like you said, this is a pretty common practice for back then.
Yeah, and it's not just back then, but it's gosh, these cultures are all over the world, and they're through all time. Like, let's just walk through some history. If you go to the tables of the Roman law, so this dating to 450 BC, listen to what the Roman law says. A notably deformed infant shall be killed immediately, and the father shall be given power over a son, the power of life and death. So, like, in Rome, this was good. You go to Strabo, first century Celtic culture, and it says he's writing about the people then, and he describes how they would take entire families, men, women, and children, they would encapsulate them inside like wicker statues made of wood and straw, and they would burn them alive as human offerings. And this is the first century. Jesus is living during this time. You go to North Africa with Carthage, and you've got Plutarch, another historian who goes down here. And listen, like they're sacrificing their kids in pagan rituals of worship that were horrendous. Listen to what Plutarch writes. He says, you'd go to the markets, and with full knowledge and understanding, they themselves offered up their own children, and those who had no children would buy little ones from poor people and cut their throats as if they were so many lambs or young birds. Meanwhile, the mother stood by without tear or moan, but should she utter a single moan or let fall a single tear, she had to forfeit the money, and her child was sacrificed nonetheless. So they're selling their own kids to be sacrificed. You go to the whole Roman Empire, you had the practice of exposure. You know what that is, right?
Leaving babies out.
Yeah, you don't want a baby, just throw them out. Let the wolves get them, let the heat get them, let the cold get them. And it was child sacrifice on a massive scale. And when was child sacrifice outlawed in the Celtic regions? When Christianity came. Yeah. When was child sacrifice banned in North Africa? When Christianity came. When did exposure get overthrown? When Christianity came. And I mean, you can go through the Aztecs, tons of child sacrifice. We have the Florentine Codex, and it says they assembled children whom they slew in the first month, buying them from their mothers. So again, Aztec cultures, mothers selling their kids to be sacrificed. When did it end in Central America?
Christians.
When Christianity came. You go down to South America, and they've found mass graves of children that have been slaughtered for this practice. When did that stop? When the Christians came. You look at India, and there was a practice where women would not only be sacrificed when their husbands died, where they would throw living widows on the funeral pyres of their husbands and burn them alive, but you found widows that would, or mothers that would take their own children and throw them into the Ganges River as an opportunity to worship. And that was going on until the 1800s when William Carey, a missionary, goes over there during the time when British started colonizing that part of the world. And he says, I've presented three petitions or representations to government for the purpose of having the burning of women and other modes of murder abolished. In the case of infanticide and the voluntary drowning in the river, laws were made to prevent these, which have been successful. So again, when did it stop in India?
Pretty recently.
When it was colonized by a Christian Western nation. And so all of this to say, the ethic of Christianity is so hostile to child sacrifice that wherever it exists, it doesn't go away until Christianity comes. But here's the other side. When Christianity retreats, guess what comes back? Like, we're living in a world that since 1973 has committed 2.1 to 2.9, this is World Health Organization, billion abortions in the last 50 years.
Wow. One fourth of our world.
More than 65 million here. 65 million.
That's crazy.
So this idea that we're looking down our noses at these ancient savage cultures that are willing to take the lives of their children, like, we better watch out for our own hypocrisy, because we sacrifice our kids to the idols of convenience and career and wealth and status and comfort. Like, we're not much better. The human heart, the human nature is pretty gross. And we find this emerging again. And the Lord hates it. In fact, cultures that engage in it tend to lose his favor pretty quickly. And so here you have the Lord that is now changing Abraham's heart to not be enslaved to this fear of death, right? That has controlled and wrecked his life all along the way. Like, I've got to figure this out. I've got to figure this out in my own strength. Now he's free. Trust the Lord. Now he's doing these incredible things. And I want you to listen to Genesis 22, verse 15, when the Lord comes and renews his promise. But now the promise is being seen through the eyes of a heart that believes in the resurrection. It says, the angel of the Lord. So the Lord calls to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn. You hear that?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? This isn't a mutual covenant. Like, I didn't ask your permission. I didn't come to you and said, hey, Abraham, if you do all this stuff, this will happen. He says, by myself I have sworn. Like, I'm doing this. And I want you to see it so that you can be at peace. Like, Will, your salvation does not rely on you.
Yeah.
I've already made the promise. What are you freaking out about? Like, let me remind you, by myself I have saved you. By myself I went to the cross. By myself I lived the perfectly righteous life and clothed you in it. Why are you white-knuckling it through life? I've done this by myself. You didn't contribute anything to this except screwing up to where your salvation was necessary in the first place, right?
Yeah.
I love that. By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord. Because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and I will surely multiply your offspring. In other words, you demonstrated faith and now watch everything that happens here. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to surely multiply your offspring as the stars of the heaven and the sand that's on the seashore, and your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies. And in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed because you've obeyed my voice. Your faith became real. Now you have a son, and now watch what happens. Your faith grew legs.
Yeah.
It's pretty awesome.
And it's cool that, like, a lot of people don't love that we call the angel of the Lord Jesus. I don't know if you've ever seen the comment section. But this is,
there's different,
I think,
theories.
This is the clearest one, but it says, and the angel of the Lord called, and then by myself I've sworn, declares the Lord. Like, he's speaking as the Lord. He's not saying, well, God told you this, let me pass on the message. He's saying, no,
really good.
I'm the Lord.
Yeah, good. I mean, I come into this kind of already convinced of it, but what you just said, like, that's spot on. By myself, declares the Lord. That then is the Lord, right? So this is the win for Abraham, and this is where the book of Genesis starts closing out his story, is you're meant to go, man, after all that, God didn't walk away from him, and this guy has rock-solid hope in the power of God to bring forth resurrection.
Yeah.
He has rock solid faith that God's going to keep his promises, rock solid faith that life is going to triumph over death and barrenness. And so listen to the way Hebrews 2 describes this. And he's pulling this up in Hebrews 2. It says, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death. So Jesus, he knows what we've walked through, but he's destroying the power of death. That is the devil. And delivering all those who through the fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. Like, do you hear what that is? Like, what is the lifelong slavery? Like, if you're going through this and you're like, I don't know what's going to happen. My whole life could be defined by this. Or what if I don't gain this? What if I don't win this? What if my approval and my fame and my money and my da-da-da-da-da? And it's like, if that's what you're living for, then you're living as though, you know, there's a timer that's been turned upside down and you've got to get all this stuff. Otherwise, your life's going to be rendered meaningless and a failure. But what does the hope of resurrection do for you? Even if you fail here, even if things go bad here, guess what's coming? An everlasting, infinite inheritance. Life will triumph over death. Jesus has secured for you an inheritance that no one can take away. No one can snatch you out of his hands. Death will not have the last word over you and anything else that's been invested in him. Like, everything comes back to you, multiplied with an infinite length and probably infinite scope. Like, so you're not a loser.
Yeah.
You get to live going, like, even if things fall apart in this life, I have the hope of a resurrection where all things will be made right, where there is no more mourning, there is no more pain and crying and death and all of those things, because the fallen nature of the world is passing away. It's dying. Death is dying. And God is bringing about a new order that one day we will inherit. And what does that do for us in the middle of, like, scrambling and white knuckling it? Like, what are we gonna achieve it in this life? It's like, well, yeah, give it your best. You live a good life. Chase after big dreams. Mm-hmm. But now you have the freedom that even if you fail in moments or seasons, resurrection assures you're more than a conqueror.
Yeah.
We're no longer in what Hebrews is saying, lifelong slavery, as though there's a brick wall that we run into that's the end. Now that brick wall's gone. Now you can run full steam into what looks like a brick wall, knowing that it's just paper mache.
It's awesome.
You're going to run right through it. And on the other side, everything is made right. And then the Hebrew says, for surely it is not the angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. And who's Abraham? He is the one that learned not to be subject to lifelong slavery because God gave him faith in the resurrection.
It's amazing.
And so, like, we're going to summarize the next chapter, because if you've ever looked at the next chapter, what is it all about?
Picking out the grave site for Sarah.
It's pretty lengthy too.
It gives a good amount of text to that.
It's a lot. Like if we went through Genesis 23, it's like him haggling with somebody over a plot. And what's significant and why we're going to summarize it is it's not significant how they negotiate, or at least I can't find anything there. What is significant is the location. And the Bible wants to beat that into your head, because Sarah's going to die in Genesis 23. And then Abraham is in grief. Here's a husband who has failed a lot, who has, you know, failed to love his wife well quite a bit. But listen to what it says. He goes and starts negotiating in the city of Hebron, right? This is where, if you remember in Genesis 18, where God comes, God comes with the two angels, and he says, yeah, at the trees of Mamre at Hebron, and there's a cave of Machpelah, all these names that you find in Genesis 23. And he's like, this time next year, you're going to have a son. And Sarah laughs at him. Abraham had laughed at him. And so now they've had a son, and God has proven that he's a God of resurrection. And so when Sarah dies, Abraham goes to this guy, Ephron the Hittite, and he's like, I need to buy this land. And he's like, oh, you know, I want to be a good neighbor to you. We've seen, you know, how God favors those that you favor. And so like, here, you can have it. And Abraham's like, no, I want to buy it. I want it to be mine. This is really important to me. And so they're back and forth. And eventually the guy's like, fine, all right, I'll sell it to you. And Abraham buys this land, and it's very specific. It says in 23 verse 17, it says, so Ephron's field, which was in Machpelah, which faced Mamre, the field and the cave which was in it. Why is it giving you all these details? Why not just say he buried her somewhere? The field and the cave which was in it, and all the trees which were in the field. Gee, what happened to those trees that were within all the confines of its border were deeded over to Abraham. And so Abraham buries his wife in a cave that comes out and overlooks what? The trees of Mamre at Hebron, which is exactly where God came and spoke to Sarah and gave her the promise, you will have a son this time next year.
Yeah, resurrected the womb.
But that son's lineage is going to bless all the nations, and eventually he's the one that we talked about in Genesis 3 that will stomp the head of the serpent and overthrow death. And so Abraham so believes in the resurrection now that he's not just saying, okay, I'm laying her down in this place where I can go visit her body.
Yeah, she's here forever.
I'm laying her down because I anticipate one morning she's going to wake up, and I want her first sight, her first view, to be that, the place where God came and gave her the promise, where she laughed. And on that morning, the morning of the resurrection, we'll all be laughing, right? And so Sarah's buried there. Then Abraham's going to be buried there. Isaac will be buried there. Rebecca will be buried there. Jacob will be buried there. Leah will be buried there. All the major patriarchs are buried in this place. It's called the tomb, and Herod built a thing over top of it called the Tomb of the Patriarchs that you can still go to in modern day Hebron, still there. You can look at the structure, Google it online, and they have found that there are indeed caves underneath this structure where they believe the patriarchs are buried. But what does this show? Why does it give you this whole chapter? Because the only reason why it would focus all that is Abraham's not looking to just say, hey, be buried here. This is where I want you to be resurrected. And so Abraham's coming to the end. You know, he's going to be dead in chapter 25, where he's going to be buried. Next chapter 24 is when he's going to search to get a bride for Isaac to continue the line. But here you see Abraham is coming to the end of his life as somebody who's been freed from that lifelong slavery of death. He now trusts in the resurrection. He mourns his wife with hope. He's willing to lay everything at the altar of God, trusting that he will get it back from God infinite fold. He's a changed man because he believes in resurrection. And I think it's instructive to us and anyone listening that believing in the power of resurrection will make your life way better here. It will give you freedom here. But what does the Bible say? That those who confess with their mouth that Jesus is Lord and that God raised him from the dead, what? They shall be saved. Believe in the resurrection changes your life. That's the meaning of the whole story of Abraham. And so that particular spot, when the spies go into the Holy Land, later on they go to Hebron. When David is anointed king, it will be at Hebron. Like, Hebron before the capital moves to Jerusalem. This location where the patriarchs are buried is going to be an especially holy spot in the history of Israel because it's the place where they expressed the hope of resurrection. So we're going to leave it there. And I just want to commend this to you, that we should be people of resurrection that are always waiting for God, not just to raise dead bodies, but to bring everything back to life. Yeah. Our marriages, our lives, our hopes, our dreams, our joy. God brings things back from the dead. And so we'll leave it there. I want to thank you so much for watching this episode of The Bible Show. Join us next time as we go into Genesis 24 and this incredible story where God is going, or where Abraham, excuse me, where Abraham is going to send his servant to find a bride for Isaac, and the incredible symbolism at play in that. Join us next time. God bless. Thanks for listening to The Bible Show. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to like and subscribe and leave a kind review to help us in the world of tech algorithms. Also, feel free to share with a friend. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Bible Show.